Dr. Ezra, reel 2.
And bring them in. Mm-hmm. But by that time, of course, some companion, if it was a wound, everyone carried a field dressing on them. Everyone in the regiment. And they either put it on themselves, they were wounded, or put it on a companion. That was the first line of treatment they ever got. And then the stretcher bearers took them over, and then they brought them in as quickly as they could to the first aid post that I made in the dugout, just 50 yards behind the trenches, actually. And there we did the best we could to them, stopping hemorrhages and that sort of thing. Mm.
How big was the dugout?
Well, it was enough to hold 20 or 30 wounded men in, mm-hmm. and ourselves.
And when you had the wounded men in there, did you have special beds prepared for them, or did you lay them on stretchers?
Oh, I lay them on stretchers. No beds. I mean, the quicker you got them off, the better.
Mm. I see.
You rang up the ambulance straight away. We had field telephones there, which were often broken by the shelling, which made things awkward, but in the ordinary way, when things were fairly quiet and there were just a few casualties, and just rang them up, and they came up straight away in the middle of the day. They were never fired on under the Geneva Convention.
What range of medical equipment would you have available to you in the first aid post?
First aid dressing, which everybody had, morphia, and that was all. Mm-hmm. That was all. We never attempted any major surgery or anything like that in the trenches. One couldn't do it.
Could you tell me about the main forms of treating wounds as a frontline medical officer?
The only thing you could had at your disposal was to cover the wound, to keep them from getting infected, and stopping hemorrhage by a compression on the main vessel if they were hemorrhaging and bleeding to death, and or putting a tourniquet around the leg or arm if it was shot off and bleeding profusely. You had to stop the whole thing by putting a tourniquet on, but you couldn't keep a tourniquet on longer than an hour without them losing their leg altogether, stopping the blood supply. Mm. So it was very necessary to get them a field ambulance so they could ligature the vessels, and the quicker that was done, the better. Mm. Very necessary in a case like that to get them shot off the ambulance as soon as possible, within 5 or 10 minutes.
Did the fact that you had to work in a frontline dugout under conditions which obviously would not be very sanitary, did that fact, the fact that it wasn't a clean environment in which to do medical work, create any problems for the patients or for you as their doctor?
Oh, yes, I believe several people got tetanus afterwards from infection from the ground, which was carried in shelled areas, very much like it was carried in farmland during my Norwich time.
Was that widespread, would you say?
Yes, it made more liable to get tetanus from being, well, the ground wasn't in a very healthy state. It had been shelled over for a long time and rather septic sort of condition.
Apart from this problem and the others we've already talked about, were there any other particular difficulties which you can recollect for a medical officer working in a frontline trench?
There weren't any difficulties. There was the lack of opportunity of doing things in the front line. It was all first aid work. The only value of an officer, a medical officer, being in the first line trench was the morale it had on the men. Mm-hmm. I remember going into the first night we ever went into the trenches, a couple of fellows thought I didn't hear and said, "Good God, M.O.'s come up with us. That makes you feel better, chum, doesn't it?"
Yes. Yes, I can see that.
And then I realized that I was doing some good by being there. Medically, I felt I was doing no good.
Yes. Now, I understand from what you've told me that there would be very little in the way of refined medical treatment in the frontline trenches and that you would get your patients away as quickly as possible. Nonetheless, were there not some occasions when, owing to the condition of a patient, you just had to carry out fairly major medical work in the frontline trench?
There's no condition you can do any medical major medical work except stopping hemorrhage. That was a very primitive method. By the pressing on the pressure point of the vessel was bleeding, that sometimes stopped it. Or if it didn't stop it, you had to put a tourniquet on, and you couldn't leave that on longer than an hour, so you had to rush them to the hospital, to the field ambulance as soon as possible, otherwise they'd have got gangrene of the stump. And
yes. What was the practice for moving patients from the frontline trenches to the casualty clearing stations? At what time of the day would you move them, and how would they be moved exactly?
Well, from the trenches to the field ambulance, you could move them any time, because they were protected by having the Red Cross on the top of the ambulance. And that it was a clever convention that you never fired on non-combatants or hospitals and that sort of thing, and it was very well maintained, no doubt about that,
mm-hmm.
on both sides.
Mm-hmm. I see. Right. Good. While you were working in France as a medical officer, did you have many cases of what later came to be described as shell shock?
Yes. Yes. I remember when I was captured, a fellow running in, he was a well-known shell shocker. He'd done it before. An officer came in, threw himself on the floor and said, "Oh, I'm shell-shocked, went into sort of, you know, spasms. And he was just a frightened man. And later, in the Second World War, that came to be recognized as shell shock. But in the First World War, that was just fear. But I never reported that to anybody, of course. I just sent him back.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other particular cases which you can remember?
I remember a fellow joining us who'd been very heavily shot over at Mons. He joined us in the later stage of the war. And there was the first time we went out on a route march, we had to move from one place to another. Every time he heard a shell in the air, we took no notice of it. We were so used to them not coming near us or hitting us. He threw himself on the floor, you know, lay down until it all passed.
Mm.
That was a case of shock, that he'd been so much of that and seen so many killed by it that he expected every shell that came to kill him. He threw himself down on the ground at once.
I believe there was another case which you remember.
When we were having our fortnight's rest out of the line, which was a habit when one was occupying the trenches, you had a fortnight in and a fortnight in a village 2 or 3 miles behind of resting period. It was during one of these periods that the colonel sent for me and said, "I have a very unpleasant duty for you to perform, which I won't like any more than you do." And then he told me what it was all about. Apparently one of our own men, had centred himself from the front line on 2 occasions when a battle had started. And after the battle was over, he came back and made some excuse that he'd mislaid the way. Well, of course, I realized that this was a very serious offense, and the first time I sentenced him to some severe sentence myself. But it happened again. I realized that he must be sent up to Army headquarters for a court-martial. They court-martialed him and sentenced him to death by a firing squad. And the unpleasant task The colonel set me was to attend the shooting and to pin on his heart a piece of coloured flannel so that they'd give the marksman something to fire at.
I think that you went in and saw the man first, yes. Did you not?
Yes, that's coming later. The following morning he was to shot at dawn. I lay awake thinking of it all night, and I thought, well, I'll try to help this fellow a bit. So I took down a cup full of brandy and presented it to him, and I said, drink this and you won't know very much about it. He said, what is it? I said, it's brandy. He said, well, I've never drunk spirits in my life. There's no point in me starting now. That, to me, was a sort of spurious sort of courage, in a way. Two men came and led him out of the hut where he'd been on guarded all night. And as he left the hut, his legs gave way. Then one could see the fear entering his heart. Rather than march to the firing spot, he was dragged along. When we got there, he was had his hands tied behind his back. He was put up against a wall. His eyes were bandaged, and the firing squad were given the order to fire. The firing squad consisted of eight men, only two of which had their rifles loaded. The other two carried blank ammunition. That was so that they wouldn't actually know who had fired the fatal shot. I wondered at the time, what on earth will happen if they miss him, they don't kill him completely. And I was very anxious about that. But when they fired, he fell to the ground, writhing, as all people do, even if they've been killed. They have this reflex action of writhing about, which goes on for some minutes. I didn't know whether he'd been dead or not. But at that moment, the sergeant in charge stepped forward, put a revolver to his head, and blew his brains out. And that was the coup de grace, which I understood afterwards, I learnt afterwards, always carried out in these cases of shooting.
There's a couple of questions I wanted to ask you about this. Really, to ask you as a doctor, this was obviously a very radical punishment for a man whose crime was what perhaps today might be regarded as a nervous illness. As a medical man at the time, did you think this sentence and this penalty was a reasonable one?
Oh, I think it was absolutely essential. It was setting a bad example to the men. They were beginning to feel that you only had to walk off during a battle and then come back afterwards and you escaped any penalty of death or mutilation. It was setting a bad example. It must have happened. I dare say in the Second World War it didn't happen so much. They were looked on as shell shock cases instead of being just as they were, cowards, and I think it was a necessary punishment.
Yes, in the Second World War they certainly would have been regarded as shell shock cases. Do you think that the attitude of medical people to cases of this kind in the Second World War demonstrated rather more enlightenment? Or do you think that they were rather softer?
I think they were rather softer. I think they were softer, yes.
The paradox of this case, I suppose, is that the man refused to accept the alcoholic anesthetic that you offered him, which was a kind of bravery and seems inconsistent with the crime he had been accused of.
Yes, but the crime was planned, definitely. He'd done it twice, you see, and setting a very bad example. And desertion in peacetime is a bad thing to do. But in wartime, to desert when a battle about to take place and leave all your comrades in the lurch was an unheard-of thing, of course, and must be punished in that sort of way.